Wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered, beloved community radio station. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning, scholarships, and other tuition opportunities available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. I'm your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, Fran Michel. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Our theme song was performed by Joe Clement. The Old Mole takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolutionary forces that subvert the terrain of capital and capitalism. That's hard work on difficult terrain, and many people have been feeling the strain of late. Today's show explores some of the miseries created by the injustices and oppressions of white supremacist, heterosexist, neoliberal capitalism. But we also look to some of the creative resistance that reimagines the past, the future, and offers us the possibility of dancing through our revolution. In particular, dancing between segments today, we'll hear music from actor, singer, composer Janelle Monáe. For those segments on today's show, we'll hear from Bill Resnick, talking with historian Anne Parsons about misery, madness, and other issues related to her forthcoming book, From Asylum to Prison, Deinstitutionalization and the Rise of Mass Incarceration After 1945. They discuss the complex relation between deinstitutionalization, with its aspiration to care for people in their communities instead of locking them in asylums, and the contemporaneous rise of mass incarceration, so that now the state intervenes not to provide needed services and ensure jobs, housing, education, and health care, but instead intervenes only when people are seen as committing a crime, which becomes all the more likely as lives become less stable and less tolerable. Tom Becker shares a reading about the debilitating consequences of extreme wealth inequality on the well-being of society in general, not just on the poor and disenfranchised. And Jan Hocken joins me to talk about the 1996 film The Watermelon Woman and the creative use of history and cinema. We chose to talk about that film, the first feature directed by an African-American lesbian, in honor of Pride, the celebration commemorating the start of the modern gay liberation movement. When, on a June night in 1969, New York City police yet again began harassing and trying to arrest the drag queens and other queer folk at the Stonewall Inn Bar. Queers of color Stormé DeLarvery, Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, and many others fought back, resisting the carceral control of the police state. Hundreds of others joined them, and the uprising continued for days. The increased organizing spurred by the Stonewall Rebellion has yielded important changes in the last 50 years. The American Psychological Association no longer considers homosexuality a mental illness. Sodomy is no longer a crime in the United States. Same-sex couples can legally marry and jointly adopt children. Many states and cities offer legal protections against discrimination on the basis of sexuality. And lots of corporations have discovered the advantages of targeting queer consumers. This weekend, June 16th and 17th, is the Portland Pride Northwest Festival and Parade at Waterfront Park. For $65, you can get a VIP pass to the festival grounds and not have to wait in line with the rabble to enter that part of the public city park. There are other benefits, too, like a private upscale bathroom. By donating, you'll be joining sponsors including Amazon, Wells Fargo, Radiocab, Comcast, and other fine organizations. But not Masterpiece Cake Shop. The Supreme Court recently ruled in favor of bakers who don't want to sell wedding cakes to same-sex couples. Meanwhile, references to LGBT programs and resources have been stripped from government websites across agencies. A trans woman recently died in ICE custody after she was unable to obtain HIV/AIDS medication. At least 12 trans people, mostly women of color, have been murdered this year in the U.S. And let's not forget the suffering of our non-queer sisters and brothers. Suicide rates are up all across the U.S. Asylum seekers fleeing violent homelands have had their children ripped away from them and locked up in secret. Houselessness is increasing dramatically. And a TransCanada pipeline exploded in West Virginia less than 6 months after its opening, when the company president described it as a best-in-class pipeline with many years of safe, reliable, and efficient operation in its future. So we are all really going to need a party this weekend. Can we agree? First the revolution, then cake. In better news today, the KBOO website is up and running again. So again, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm/program/old-mole-variety-hour. Probably just Old Mole Variety Hour would work too. We invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you're interested in getting involved with the Mole, or if you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one lowercase word, at gmail.com. We turn now to Bill Resnick's conversation with historian Ann Parsons.
Hi, Ann Parsons. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ann Parsons teaches, she writes, she helps people understand their place in U.S. history. She teaches history and directs the public history program at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. She writes, her upcoming work, about to be published in October, is Asylum to Prisons, Deinstitutionalization and the Rise of Mass Incarceration After 1945. So, Ann Parsons, it's pretty widely known that the closing of most state mental hospitals through the late 20th century and the rise of mass incarceration, they happened at the same time, and that gave rise to the idea that this deinstitutionalization was a prime cause of mass incarceration. You've written that it's much more complicated, and give us the background and your assessment.
You really hit the nail on the head there when you say that the closure of hospitals and the rise of prisons were really happening at the same time, and a lot of times people blame deinstitutionalization for the rise of prisons. But what I've found in my research is that actually, as hospitals were closing, many of those people who were formerly at hospitals went to nursing homes or were returned to their communities, and many people actually were not then imprisoned. There was a group of people that ended up being picked up by the police and put them back in hospitals, put back in prisons, but that was not what happened largely. What I found generally was that deinstitutionalization was this moment when society was really rejecting the idea that we could confine people sheerly because of their psychiatric disorder. And as we were rejecting that notion, often called anti-institutionalism, the same time in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, this fear-based law and order politics was rising up, and ultimately we really embraced a new type of institutionalism, that of prisons. So we were rejecting the asylum, and prisons really rose up. And ultimately, those prisons absorbed many of the functions of the former asylums.
Right. One little footnote that's interesting about your work. The old asylum was also, it functioned to suppress deviance, but in the 50s and 60s, deviance was being redefined. So the old asylums had a lot of people who, sexually active young women, were put in mental hospitals, especially amongst the rich. And also gays and lesbians were committed to mental hospitals, often by their families or by doctors, because gay and lesbian conduct was seen as terrible deviance and a sign of mental illness. That was my sense
of... Yes, correct. Many young women who were sexually active were identified as sexually deviant and then placed into hospitals. But also, homosexuality, as it was called at the time, was not only seen as deviant, but it was also legally criminal in many ways. Sodomy was criminalized. So people who were deemed sex offenders could be arrested and actually placed in hospitals rather than prisons.
Let's talk about mass incarceration. That's when I interrupted. In your writing, you talk about the many reasons. I think we should, one of them, of course, is that some of the people were, you know, without money, without friends often, without any support, wound up on the streets, and the police didn't know what to do, and they went into jails, and they brought them to jail. Sometimes they are inebriated in one way or another, and they wound up just being processed as prisoners and put away for a while. But let's talk about the social reasons for the rise of the prison and the prison industry, social and political reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, since I focus on the intersection of the mental health and the prison system, I'll talk specifically about those and how they influenced it. One thing that deinstitutionalization did unexpectedly cause was a lot of fear-based language around the release of patients, even though many patients actually were not dangerous at all. What I was finding in the 1970s, 1980s, as I was going through papers in the Philadelphia archives, was fear of quote-unquote maniacs on the streets was at one point one of the big fears in Philadelphia. So this in many ways unfounded, often focused on very high-profile cases, not many people. But deinstitutionalization was releasing a new tide of discrimination against people with psychiatric disorders in the 1970s and 80s. And so that was one of the things that was fueling that fear-based law and order politics of that period, fear of the streets. It really ends up being embodied by Goldwater in his presidential campaign, taken up by Lyndon B. Johnson, and then through Nixon and Reagan, these wars on crime. So really, deinstitutionalization did unexpectedly kind of fuel some of these law and order politics that often were more political than actually grounded in fact.
Mm-hmm. And even psychiatry, you know, the sort of the science of medicine decided that, I mean, a lot of the psychiatrists began defining schizophrenia and other mental disorders as leading to great paranoia and violence, which mm-hmm. in fact turns out to be not the case. So mm-hmm. that a lot of people with problems were defined as criminally insane, even though they weren't likely to commit crimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. This is also really where race comes into play, too. Race is a critical component of the rise of mass incarceration, as books like The New Jim Crow or the documentary 13th have shown. When it comes to mental health, there's a really great book called Protest Psychosis by Jonathan Metzl. It looks at how, as he calls it, schizophrenia became a black disease, how psychiatrists in the 1960s and 1970s increasingly focused the diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenic around African Americans, and African American men in particular were more likely to be diagnosed with it, and as a result be diagnosed as criminally mentally ill and placed in more secure, maximum security hospitals. And so you really see this concept of who is dangerous is incredibly inflected by racism in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s.
Which, in fact, still, it seems to me, is discuss that. I mean, there's just a huge amount of racism and fear based in these law and order politics and get tough on crime and protect your communities. And that's still going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons, one of the main arguments of my work is that as we're thinking about mental health and how to address our crisis of the fact that our largest mental health centers are behind bars and prisons and jails today, one of the main solutions has been, okay, let's fix our mental health system. But ultimately, it's impossible to just focus on fixing the mental health system. It's really important to look at how racism is playing out in our criminal legal system today, how it's affecting people who are African American with psychiatric disabilities, how they're being picked up by the police and put into prisons and jails. It really ultimately is important for us to be really working to reduce mass incarceration and thinking about racism in that system in order to try to address this issue of mental illness and our prison system today.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Ann Parson, who teaches history, and she also directs the public history program at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And her book is going to be coming out soon, Asylum to Prisons, Deinstitutionalization and the Rise of Mass Incarceration After 1945. We've been discussing mostly the rise of mass incarceration after deinstitutionalization, which only was one of the causes of rise in the prison population. Ann Parsons, let's switch gears some. The estimates are that between, 10 and 30% of the population at some of our lockouts and prisons are people with really serious sort of mental impairments of one kind or another. Now, that's a huge number of people, far more than the number of people who were ever in asylums, and especially since many of the people, as you talked about, were in asylums for homosexual conduct, same-sex activity of one kind or another, or sometimes they were just people with dementia, Alzheimer's and stuff, if they live long enough. So we really are diagnosing, at least they're sort of diagnosing in prisons, of a tremendous number of people. And one reason, as you pointed out, was that now mental health problems are somehow criminalized. But another hypothesis is that we're driving a lot more people, I sort of hesitate to use the phrase, but it's all right in this context. We're driving people crazy. We're creating a society where people decline into deep dysfunction. How do you see it in terms of, are there really more people being, is it just more people being diagnosed, or is it that, in fact, there's a lot of factors in the social life, particularly amongst the bottom 60 or 70% of people, where a lot of them, mm-hmm. In fact, are so stressed and that in one way or another they retreat into something that's sort of similar to one of the mental health categories?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. And certainly I know it's one that's on a lot of people's minds today as we've had a few recent suicides of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, of what is the state of mental health in our world today. You know, I've been reading a lot of reports about how the rate of suicide has increased by 30% since 1999. And it's incredibly distressing that as we've learned more about mental health and also as the mental health consumer movement has grown, in fact, suicide and many other mental health disorders have been exacerbated in our modern culture. It's really distressing. When it comes to prisons, I've done tutoring in a men's prison in Illinois, in central Illinois, and I talked with them about mental health and imprisonment. And one of the things that they really responded, and I think it's important to keep in mind in this conversation, they really responded that they felt that the prison population was also over-psychiatrized, that almost all of them were given an asocial diagnosis of some sort, and that it's important to kind of be cautious as we talk about statistics, because they felt that often there would be a lot of diagnosis of people in prison that was potentially not justified. The other thing that I really learned from them is, and also from many other prison activists, is that prisons can be themselves disabling in many ways, particularly the use of solitary confinement that actually exacerbates mental illness. I don't know your thoughts on these or what you've come across in your work, Bill.
Yeah, well, at least some of the stuff I've read sees, let's say, not only does prison exacerbate any sort of underlying fragility for people, but so does homelessness, so does having dead-end, low-wage jobs or loss of work, mm-hmm. or in the end of family support. or illness, or it seems to me the society just has fewer resources for caring for people and supporting them. And in fact, income has gone down. So a lot of these men who might have started families and been stabilized by their wives and other families and their workmates in fairly stable jobs where they could earn a living, they can't any longer. It seems to me that the life opportunities for a lot of the people at in the bottom 60%, and some are downwardly mobile from the upper middle class, they wind up sort of solitary on drugs or in sort of male groups that are really irresponsible and drug using. It seems to me that we've made a society where there's lots of people who are unable actually to find a dignified life. Mm-hmm. Even when they fight hard to do it, even when they're sort of smart but a little bit off, and they lose jobs or they can't ever get them, or they suffer a disabling injury so that they can't, and then they're just tossed on the garbage heap in society, it seems to me. I don't know what the contribution of that is to this mass incarceration, but I suspect it's something.
And I think you're really onto something, that the lack of sustainable livelihoods and, you know, access, often education. I know I'm in North Carolina right now. It's a huge struggle over access to quality education, housing, transportation, jobs. It's really central. At the very same time, you know, the vision in the 1960s, when President Kennedy announced in 1963, I think just a few weeks before he was shot, and signed the Community Mental Health Centers Act. And the vision was really of reducing asylums and being able to have a society that was able to care for people with a variety of mental health disorders. And the vision was really to be able to support people in their communities. I think the lack of sustainable livelihoods really undercuts that vision. The other thing, and this is where mass incarceration came in, prisons are so expensive today that ultimately they were built up. The states across the country really poured billions of dollars into their prisons. And so for us today, one of the great possibilities of decarceration is reducing how much we're putting into prisons and instead helping to shift that into access to medical, mental health services, housing supports, employment. Although I do think you're right that it's about thinking about society as a whole, not just what the state can offer. But right now, the state often ends up putting its money into people at the point that they break the law rather than at the point of need.
Ann Parsons, really good talking to you. Maybe another time we can talk about what really could be done and should be done with the, just by reprogramming some of the monies that are now being used to support prisons and the prison industry and the prison guard unions that have a lot of power in maintaining this whole apparatus. And there's, of course, the new Jim Crow as well. Anyway, thanks a lot. We're out of time.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate being here.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Take care.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and I'll be joined at the end of the show by Jan Hocken to talk about the 1996 movie The Watermelon Woman. Before that music, we heard Bill Resnick and historian Ann Parsons talking about the complex relation between deinstitutionalization and mass incarceration. Thanks to John Nelson for his work editing that piece. You'll be able to find that discussion and more online in a day or two at the Old Mole Variety Hour pages on the website for KBOO Portland at kboo.fm. You can also find us by visiting, liking, and following the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and following us at Old Mole on Twitter. We also just heard some of Janelle Monáe's Tightrope from her 2010 album, The Arc Android. Because whether you're high or low, you got to keep your balance on the tightrope. For more about that, we'll hear next from Tom Becker, reading about inequality, social dysfunction, and misery.
Thank you, Fran. The burdens and devastations of extreme wealth inequality, of course, fall most heavily on the poor. But the pernicious effects of such inequality also corrupt and degrade the entire society in which it is allowed to flourish under the unholy mandates of neoliberal capitalism. Today I'm reading an article which addresses these issues titled Inequality, Social Dysfunction, and Misery by Graham Peebles. Year on year, the economic divisions and subdivisions in the world deepen, and the associated social ills increase. The rich, comfortable, and the very extremely rich keep getting richer, and the rest, well, while some may be raised up out of crippling poverty into relative poverty, the majority of people continue to live under a blanket of economic insecurity and largely remain where they are. Straddling the global ladder of economic and social division sit the multi-billionaires. There are some 2,208 billionaires in the world today, 42 of whom, and that's down from 61 in 2016, according to a recent poll, own the same amount of wealth as the poorest half of humanity combined. Together with their lesser cohorts, this coterie of trillionaires sucked up 82% of the wealth generated in the world last year, while the 3.7 billion people who make up the poorest half of the world saw no increase in their wealth. Income and wealth inequality is not simply a monetary issue. It is a complex social crisis that supports and strengthens notions of superiority and inferiority, and was described by President Barack Obama in 2013 as the defining challenge of our time. Today, the obscene levels of inequality are the result of the neoliberal economic system. This extreme form of capitalism took hold first in America and Britain in the early 1980s, when Reagan and Thatcher ruled. Workers' rights were trampled on, society was a dirty word, and community responsibility was abandoned to selfishness and greed. With the aid of the World Bank and the IMF, neoliberalism swiftly spread throughout the world, polluting life in every city, town, and village with its divisive, cruel ideology. Commercialization and competition are key principles and have infiltrated every area of contemporary life. Everything and everyone is seen as a commodity. The size of one's bank account determines the level of health care, education, and housing availability, as well as one's access to culture and freedom to travel. Social injustice is inherent in the system, as is inequality, which is itself a major form of injustice. Inequality strengthens deep-seated social imbalances based on class and social standing. In a world where everything is classified, commercialized, and priced, that is, attributive value, external wealth, and position have become the common criteria for determining the internal worth of a human being. Comparison and imitation follow. Individuality is perverted and fear fostered. Fear of inadequacy, fear of failure, fear of not being loved, because not deserving love and not being able to afford love. Resentment and anger and self-loathing are fed, leading to a range of mental health issues, including anxiety, depression, and drug and alcohol addiction. The impact of financial inequality on the health and well-being of society has been extensively studied by Richard Wilkerson, Professor Emeritus of Social Epidemiology at the University of Nottingham. In order to establish national levels of inequality, Wilkerson and his team used a benchmark based on how much richer the top 20% is to the bottom 20%. Japan and Scandinavia, Finland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, come out most equal, and now Slovenia and the Czech Republic have moved towards that group. Israel, New Zealand, Australia, Britain, Portugal, and USA are found to have the greatest levels of inequality, and by some margin. Recent data suggests that Russia, South Africa, and Turkey should now be added to the most unequal pile. Germany, Spain, and Switzerland sit somewhere in the middle. Data relating to a range of social issues are examined. The most unequal countries were found to have lower life expectancy than more social equal societies, higher infant mortality, many more homicides, larger prison populations by 10 to 15 times, applied longer sentences, had higher teenage pregnancies, lower mathematic literacy levels, more obesity, less social mobility, and according to the World's Value Survey, a great deal less trust. In more equal countries like Sweden and Norway, around 65% of people trust others, whereas in unequal societies like the U.S., a mere 15% admitted to trusting their fellow citizens. In all areas, countries with high levels of inequality did worse, in most cases much worse, than their more equal nations. Mental health, for example, and these figures are from the World Health Organization, in Japan, around 8% of the population suffers from some form of mental health issue, compared to 30% in the U.S. Children are considerably healthier in more equal countries, based on UNICEF's Index of Child Well-Being, and feel a good deal happier. Wilson concludes, what we're looking at is a general social dysfunction related to inequality. It's just not one or two things that go wrong. It's most things. In one of the primary purposes of any socioeconomic system is to create environments in which human beings can grow and live happily together. Then the nations suffering under the shadow of inequality need to learn from Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Finland, which are not just the least unequal, they are also the happiest countries in the world. Throughout Scandinavia, public services, education, which is probably the best in the world, healthcare and housing are valued, and taxes levied in order to fund them properly. There are greater levels of social justice. This allows for trust to develop, and where there is trust, relationships flower. The extremes of staggering wealth and stifling poverty don't exist as they do in the more unequal parts of the world. Social mobility is greater, and the dream of betterment more realistic. As Richardson says, if Americans want to live the American dream, they should go and live in Denmark. The case for fundamental change in the economic order and a shift away from the destructive values it promotes is becoming irrefutable. However, change occurs only gradually, and resistance is great. In the meantime, governments, particularly in the most unequal states, need to acknowledge the connection between the dysfunction and disease within society and their socioeconomic methodology, which is literally making people ill, as well as poisoning the natural world. They need to invest properly in public services, address wage differences, ban bonuses, introduce progressive tax reform, unlike America and France, which are taking retrograde steps by designing tax codes which will fuel inequality, look to the Scandinavian countries and learn from their example. As a wise man has said, the rich must give up what they want so that the poor can have what they need. What the rich and comfortable must give up is greed, another car, another house, more designer clothes, etc. What the rest need is freedom from economic insecurity and the fear of destitution, freedom from exploitation and dependency, secure, comfortable, and well-designed accommodation, and access to good education, health care, and culture. Such essential needs are the rights of all. When made manifest, they go a long way towards establishing social justice. And where there is social justice, functional, compassionate communities do evolve, conflict is reduced, and collective harmony is cultivated. That was an article entitled Inequality, Social Dysfunction, and Misery by Graham Peebles. The article can be found on the Counterpunch webpage.
You told us we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Pursuit of happiness.
That was, again, Janelle Monáe, this time with Crazy Classic Life from her latest album, Dirty Computer. Before that, we heard Tom Becker reading from Graham Peebles about inequality, social dysfunction, and misery. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Patricia Kullberg is our engineer, and we'll be posting the show on the website later. We'll also post those links to Facebook and Twitter, and you can listen to any segments you missed, find out more about them, or share segments or share the whole show with your friends. Does it seem crazy these days to want a classic life, to want to live your life in peace, to want life, liberty, and to smell the trees? Those things get harder to come by. But we can work for a better future. If you're in Salem today at 11 a.m., you can join the Oregon Poor People's Campaign at the state capitol for nonviolent moral direct action focused on labor and good jobs, education, and housing. Tomorrow at 11:30, you can show up at Ron Wyden's office at 911 Northeast 11th for Resist Trump Tuesday. Wednesday at 6:30, you can join Portland Rising at the Jobs with Justice office at 1500 Northeast Irving in the basement conference room to hear four women from our community talk about the challenges faced by women in the workplace and the effort of unions to respond to these challenges, as well as how unions and working women have historically influenced the broader women's movement. Presentations will be followed by discussion of what issues and struggles might be next for women and unions. Thursday at noon, you can work on thawing ice by walking around the Portland Ice Detention Center, 4310 Southwest McAdam. That evening, you can join the Fossil Fuels Resistance Team for a meeting at Central Lutheran Church, room 201, 1820 Northeast 21st. Or you could do whatever else you need to do so you can be here for a better future. And we can imagine a different past as well, because maybe that's what will help us create a better world. Next on The Old Mole, I talk with Jan Hocken about a movie she hadn't seen until recently. The Watermelon Woman, released in 1996, is the first feature film directed by an African-American lesbian. The writer-director Cheryl Dunye also plays the main character, Cheryl, herself an aspiring filmmaker, who works in a video rental store with her friend Tamara, with whom she also has a videography business. Cheryl decides to make a documentary about a striking black actress she sees in a 1930s film called Plantation Memories, where she's credited only as the Watermelon Woman. While we follow Cheryl's quest for information, we also see Cheryl's romance with a white woman named Diana and Tamara's conflicts with their young white coworker Annie. We see episodes from Cheryl and Tamara's videography jobs, recording a black Jewish wedding and a black feminist music performance, clips from various old movies that Cheryl watches, street interviews asking people if they've heard of the Watermelon Woman, and Cheryl's direct address to the camera as she discusses her documentary project. Cheryl's research takes her through her mother and her mother's butch friend, Miss Shirley, to Tamara's cousin who collects black film memorabilia, to the archives of the Center for Lesbian Information and Technology with Annie, to an interview with Camille Paglia, and to an acquaintance of Diana's family who's the sister of the white woman director of Plantation Memories. Cheryl discovers that the Watermelon Woman, Faith Richardson, or Faye Richards, apparently had an affair with the white woman who directed Plantation Memories. Faye sang in Philly gay clubs and had a longtime relation with another black woman, June, who Cheryl tracks down just in time to get a letter from her before her last illness. The film ends with Cheryl's documentary and, spoiler alert, the news that the whole thing is fiction, because sometimes you have to make your own history.
Well, this film works on so many levels and is remarkable both as an intervention in Hollywood film, a commentary on film theory and Hollywood cinema and black lesbian politics. What do you think about her main device of creating a history that's been denied you, that her problem is that the character who's only identified as the Watermelon Woman in Hollywood films and her problem that so many black characters, actors were not even named. So she begins to create a history for this woman that doesn't exist. It's absent. So to what extent does that matter, that she's creating a history that is in part as much an act of her imagination as it is an uncovering of a history in archives, although you see scenes of her going to the library and women's studies, it's quite clear that by the end of the film, there is no history. It's a creative act.
Well, I think what's interesting is that in this creative act, in this creative history, this fictional history, her attempt to get information through official sources never works. So she goes to the library, and they've got nothing on the Watermelon Woman. They have some stuff on Martha Page, but not anything who's the white woman director, who's sort of based on Dorothy Arzner, who was the actual white woman director working in Hollywood in the 30s. She goes to the library, and she doesn't find anything on the Watermelon Woman. She goes to Camille Paglia, who's a cultural critic and a women's studies professor and an expert on something or other, and she gets ridiculous commentary on watermelons.
A great swipe on Camille Paglia.
It really is, and one wonders whether she was aware of how much she was being made fun of by her very existence. But her actual sources for real information that she finds are the people she knows, are her queer community fellow members of this sort of multiracial lesbian queer community. And it turns out, you know, her mother's friend, Miss Shirley, it turns out, is in the family, as she says, and talks about, oh yeah, she used to sing for all us stone butches. And,
this sort of fictive kin idea of how family is described.
Yeah, I mean, she creates a history based on the sort of counter histories that in fact people are working on discovering. I mean, as you say, the history that she creates is in a lot of ways based on actual history, in that, for instance, Hollywood did not always credit African-American actors by their actual names. I mean, Willie Best, who performed in a lot of Hollywood movies, was credited as Sleep and Eat, which is a pretty insulting name to give anybody. It's pretty much as bad as the Watermelon Woman. So, I mean, the kinds of roles that were available to black women, which her friend Tamara says she can't watch that stuff from the 30s because they're always playing mammies. That's all they could get to do. And we find out a little bit about the history of race films, that there were black filmmakers working in the 20s and 30s and 40s and making films with black casts for black audiences.
And that's an interesting history uncovered as part of the film as well.
So it's based on real history. So I think we do learn some things about the real history of Hollywood cinema, of cinema through the film. But it also then becomes this sort of enabling gesture. If you don't have the history you need, you go out and you make it. And she does construct this history that works for her, that allows her to become a filmmaker.
A lot of feminist film theory works with this idea of desire, and whose desires are produced and structured through cinema. And from a psychoanalytic point of view, as many feminist film theorists are, desire is also tied to anxiety, that we desire objects that also make us anxious, and that she is on a quest that where she struggles with her own desire. And I think part of what interested me in the film was she starts with this image from a made-up film called Plantation Memories, where this black woman is comforting a white woman whose husband is away in the Civil War. And this line, she says, "Mrs., he'll come back to you, he'll come back to you." And we return to that in the film, and it does position black women as sources of comfort to white women. It's a very, the history of black-white relationships are very much around comfort, where black people provide solace to white people. And the film also takes her into a kind of tabooed realm around that, because she has an affair with a white woman and she refuses to be kind of censored around her own sexual interest in white women. And what do you make of that in terms of the racial tensions around desiring across the racial divide? Because Spike Lee is taking that up in Jungle Fever, not only the white gaze as black subject as object of the white gaze, but how to think about black desire, in this case, black lesbian desire. You've written an article about about Dunya's work. Yes. What do you make of that, of her working with that theme?
Well, I think in this film we can see in The Watermelon Woman, she goes through this set of parallels with her relationship with Diana and Faye Richards' relationship with Martha Page.
Is the director in a white woman
who directed Plantation Memories, who in fact is played by Antonia Yuhas, who's the producer of The Watermelon Woman. So there's, and I think they had a thing going on at the time. But
she invents a lesbian relationship between the white woman director and the black actress. So and what's that about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's clearly, I mean, the sex scene between Cheryl and Diana is pretty racy, and in fact was the reason that it got some Republicans all uptight about the National Endowment for the Arts having given some money to the production of this film.
And it was a very erotic scene for its time. I mean, it's still kind of
racy, yeah.
But it's crossing the racial divide. So there's clearly
desire there. But the other characters in the film, I mean, her friend, Cheryl's friend Tamara, is very critical of her relationship with Diana. Although we can also see some problems in Tamara's relationships. And
everybody's desires are complicated.
Everybody's desires are complicated. It's true. Yeah. And other people in the film are critical of Faye's relationship with Martha Page as something that she did to get ahead in Hollywood. So, I mean, there's a way in which there's a kind of acknowledgement that part of the attraction is potentially the sort of racial privilege that white women have. That white people have a kind of cachet, perhaps, because of the unearned power that white people have in society, that is, in fact, maybe part of what's potentially sexy, but also
instrumental,
and also what's troubling about it. But then that Cheryl's relationship with Diana ends when it turns out that actually Tamara was right, and Diana has like a long history of getting involved with black people, and it seems like it's more about a sort of fetishism of race on Diana's part than her actual interest in Cheryl as a person.
Yeah. And so there are some cautionary tales there. But I also think, you know, you've written about how this film works with the idea of the gaze, and Laura Mulvey wrote a classic paper on the heterosexual male gaze, and in this there she works with that idea, and you're aware she's looking for something. She brings herself into the film, and that there's something constructed always going on in films, and also the camera is very unstable. It wavers, you know, off there in these shoots, and the camera operators, these women start looking at other women in the audience, so it wavers.
When they're doing the videography of the music event, some of the camera operators are just kind of looking around, looking at the lovely, attractive women in the audience, and that's not what you're supposed to be doing right now. You're supposed to just film the acts, okay? Stop looking at the gorgeous women in the audience.
And that was a very interesting scene, because it also brought into the film itself this idea of that there's always something that's excluded from the scene, and there's always something kind of unstable about how desire operates in film.
And that film is about desiring. And I think that's one of the really interesting things. I mean, Laura Mulvey's famous article that you mentioned, where she sort of comes up with the idea of the male gaze, which is now sort of dispersed throughout society, and people who have never read Laura Mulvey know about the idea of the male gaze, because it's such a compelling and accurate account of something going on in society. And Laura Mulvey is talking about the male gaze as shaping the narrative and the desiring structure of classic Hollywood cinema. And
the man as the holder of the gaze and woman as object of the gaze.
Yeah, that in classic Hollywood films, there's the male protagonist is looking at this attractive woman, and then the audience is also looking at the attractive woman and identifying with the male protagonist. I mean, that sort of classic film is directed at a white male heterosexual viewer. I mean, Mulvey's writing in the 70s. She doesn't go into him being a white and heterosexual male viewer, but that's...
But it still applies in a way.
Yeah.
And so how do you think she's complicating that idea with the black lesbian gaze?
Yeah,
part of it is she brings it out into her project.
Yeah. So, I mean, we definitely get the awareness that this is constructed, which is one of the things that Mulvey talks about as, you know, the fact that we're not invited to think about the fact that movies are fake, that we're invited to be sort of hypnotically absorbed in the experience of watching. As though it's naturally unfolding in front of us. We're just voyeurs. But here we have, you know, she's talking to the camera, and we know that she's operating the camera. And so it's clearly a constructed work. And it's also one that's clearly engendered by, or shaped by, spurred by black lesbian desire, black desire for another woman. I mean, she decides to make this movie because she sees this woman in the film Plantation Memories, and says, you know, girlfriend's got it going on. You know, there's something about her face. There's just something about her performance. The idea that, and this is something that in the years since Mulvey's work, more film critics have sort of noted and talked about, the idea that in fact performers exceed their role sometimes, that the structure of the film that is meant to be giving us a singular kind of view, that is meant to be directed toward the illusory coherence of the white male spectator, is in fact much more complicated.
I think also it reminded me of bell hooks and black looks, that different audiences bring different sensibilities to it, that she could look at those hideous, those old images that evoked Gone with the Wind in that era, and see something else going on there. And bell hooks speaks to that so beautifully in talking about Amos and Andy and many films that were clearly racist and produced for white audiences that mocked or erased black people, but how black audiences can take them up in new ways. And she, I think bell hooks would have liked this, like this film, is in that spirit of different ways of using these old films.
Yeah, Hooks talks about the oppositional gaze, right? So Mulvey is talking about the ways that films position their viewers, or position their viewers, or expect the intended viewer to be this heterosexual white man, whereas Hooks talks about the fact that when you're not that figure, you have to find some resistant way, oppositional way, to engage with what you're seeing.
And that's a more creative and less passive process.
Yeah, so you're not identifying, you're disidentifying, you're resisting, you're talking back to the screen, you're interpreting things in willful ways that don't align with the intentions of the director necessarily, with the intentions of the film or the screenwriter. So the ways that cultural products can be put to new uses is something that we definitely see in this film. I mean, she's working at a video store, and she, like, they have this scam, and she sees Plantation Memories because they order these films under customers' names and then send them back. So they have this way of getting the film, sort of using the system that, in a larger sense, is oppressive to serve her own ends, to
create,
serve her own creativity.
And create something subversive.
And create something new. Yeah.
And I think in closing we should say that this was not her only work. She's a remarkable filmmaker and scholar. She's Cheryl Dunier's taught at a number of colleges, film theory, and has gone on to do other work. And I think we should add a link to your article on her work.
And you can find this, or you can get in line to get a copy of this at the Multnomah County Library. I think there are some holds already, but put your hold in and you can get hold of the film.
Great way to spend an afternoon during Pride Month.
For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michelle
and Jan Hawken
talking about The Watermelon Woman.
Go see it and discuss among yourselves.
Pink like the inside of your baby, pink behind all of the doors. Crazy pink like the tongue that goes down. Maybe pink like the paradise found. Pink when you're blushing inside.
go insane. So here we are in the car, leaving traces.
That was Janelle Monáe doing her recent song, Pink. And before that, Jan Hocken and I discussing Cheryl Dooney's 1996 film, The Watermelon Woman. In a day or two, you can find all the show segments online with links to more information. You can also find links to the events I mentioned earlier in the show and the videos to the songs that we heard a little bit of today from the fabulous Janelle Monáe. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg for stupendous engineering and posting. Thanks to John Nelson for editing. Thanks to Joe Clement for his version of our theme song and to Rasa for the green mole puppet. Thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest Ann Parsons for their conversation about mental institutions, prisons, and the ways that we need to take better care of each other. Thanks to Tom Becker for his reading on the damage done by inequality under neoliberal capitalism. Thanks to Jan Hocken for talking with me about The Watermelon Woman and cinema history. Thanks to the members, volunteers, and staff of KBOO Portland for broadcasting The Old Mole, and to Jenka for saving the website. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host today. The Mole will be back next Monday with more views, reviews, and interviews.